You are listening here to Known as Legal Radio. And I'm joined today in the studio by Ryan Hayes and by Corvin Russell, who is a member of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid.
Hey.
So I guess, Corvin, this marks the third year that QAIA, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, will be marching in the Pride Parade. So what are some of the major goals of the contingent this year, and what are organizers seeking to accomplish?
Well, the goals of the contingent this year pretty much are the same as they've always been. You know, QAIA was formed because of as you mentioned earlier, the concept of pinkwashing. There's a whole campaign that was launched by Israel a couple of years ago called Brand Israel, which basically seeks to portray Israel in a positive light using things like gay rights, which have been won in Israel after decades of struggle by LGBT people there, technology, culture, etc., to sort of say, well, this is a liberal oasis in the Middle East surrounded by places where people don't have those rights, and it's a way of justifying occupation and apartheid. And so QAIA formed in response to that. So our politics have always been to draw attention to the problem of apartheid and occupation in Israel, and particularly that's a problem that affects LGBT people there too. And so we're standing with queers in Palestine, and we're bringing that message. And we're also saying that, you know, Pride is a political event. Pride is the community's event, and all people in the community have a place in Pride, whatever their identity and whatever oppression they're fighting.
So, Corvin, sort of building on that, QAIA is probably the most popular contingent in this year's Pride Parade. And while many people have rallied to its support, including longtime queer organizers in Toronto, some of whom were involved with the bathhouse raids back in 1981 that really originated Pride in Toronto, others have denounced the contingent for wanting to, quote, politicize Pride. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, you know, many of us, many gay and lesbian and trans people have actually been concerned about the commercialization of Pride. And so, you know, that message does have a certain resonance only because there's been a kind of depoliticization, especially over the last 10 years. But the roots of Pride and the essential character of Pride are extremely political. And, you know, not only political, but actually have their origins in the politics of the left. And most of the people who started Pride come out of the left and, you know, are still on the left. And so I think one of the things we've seen with this is all those people who've sort of been saying over the years, I haven't gone to Pride in years, right? It doesn't speak to me, are like, wow, actually this is still a space for mass politics. Mm-hmm. This is still our space, and we really want to assert that. And so, you know, the attempt to say this is just a party is pretty cynical, and that's also one of the things that we're trying to fight.
Right. And so, Corvin, this past week we heard, you know, terrible accounts of homophobia, threats of rape, seclusion of queer people in the detention center during the G20. And so many have called for resistance to the Toronto Police contingent in this year's Pride Parade. And a group of queer people confronted the chief of police, Bill Blair, and called for his resignation. So I'm wondering, what's QAIA's position on police participation in the Pride Parade this year?
Well, I can't say that we have a position because we're actually a pretty consensual group, and so we haven't had this discussion. But, you know, obviously not only the police, but also the military and lots of groups participate in Pride that represent institutions that are complicit in oppression and so on. And so, you know, that's something that we would speak about politically, I guess. But our call has also been, you know, because partly we've mobilized around an anti-censorship campaign, we haven't actually called for the exclusion of any group from Pride. So,
I mean, last year, Tim McCaskill spoke at an event linking the Simon and Coley Network of Queers Against South African Apartheid in the 1980s with the current rise of QAIA. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about the similarities of these two movements and why it's important to name Israel as an apartheid state.
Well, the similarities are, you know, I'm not sure. There are similarities and there are differences. So, like, in the case of SNAC, Simon and Cody Anti-Apartheid Committee, it actually started because people started getting news of political prisoners in South Africa who were who are gay men particularly, who are facing a much harder time within the struggle, also because of homophobia within the struggle and broader homophobia in South Africa. And so solidarity groups, well, really, actually, Toronto was sort of the leader of that outside of South Africa. The SNAC group was the leader. They formed to be in solidarity with those people. And it had a real effect also on making visible the presence of queers within the struggle. And that, in turn, once apartheid was dismantled, was one of the factors. Obviously, there were many, and the major one being the presence and the struggle of people inside South Africa. But one of the reasons why LGBT rights were recognized in the South mm-hmm. African Constitution the first time anywhere in the world. So this, the formation of Kwaya, as I said before, is responding in a way to something different, which is actually the use by Israel of LGBT rights as a sort of propaganda weapon. That actually did happen in South Africa too, because a lot of the discourse was the same, which was, you know, this is a liberal democracy in a sea of communist or authoritarian countries. We have certain freedoms. Look, like gay people can live here openly without fear of criminalization. So a lot of that discourse was used, and even a lot of the other discourse, which was like, why are you singling out South Africa, etc. A lot of the same strategies were used. But can you just remind me the second part of the question?
Just in terms of why it's important to name Israel as an apartheid state, because that's been the controversy, at least in terms of the Pride Committee's ban.
Totally. And one of the things that people have said is, well, why don't you just change your name? You know, why don't you just say queers who love Palestinians or queers for Palestine or whatever? Well, and the reason we don't change our name is, one is, if you change your name in response to political pressure, that is censorship. Two is, we use the word apartheid because it describes the actual system in place in Israel, Palestine. And that's a threefold. I mean, we can basically say there are different laws for people based on race, and that's the essence of apartheid. If we want to get into it, we can talk about the separation of people geographically based on race, the limiting access to land, both within 1948 Israel based on race. You know, 93% of the land in 1948 is more or less off limits to Arab citizens of Israel. Obviously, the building of the apartheid wall, Jewish-only highways, dispossession of people from their land on the West Bank, the illegal siege of Gaza, and, you know, over 20 laws on the books within 1948 which differentiate between Arab and Jewish nationals and Arab citizens of Israel. And so all of those things very clearly show that Israel's an apartheid state. And that's a judgment that's been made by the South African Human Sciences Research Council, by Bishop Desmond Tutu, by Jimmy Carter, by many other people, including politicians in Israel. So we're not saying anything that isn't being said in Israel or South Africa or many other places around the world.
Right. And so, I mean, Corbin, you've listed sort of some of the apartheid conditions. You know, very recently we saw the murder of activists aboard the Gaza flotilla, and, you know, heavy criticism from the international community, but still Israel resists any sort of meaningful change. So maybe we could you could talk to us a bit about how people can support the movement, how people can support Kwaya, and how they can get involved in the push for tangible resistance to Israel's impunity.
Well, the way you can support Kwaya is by showing up at our contingent 1 p.m. Sunday at Jarvis and Bloor. And also, not to forget, there's a Dyke March tomorrow. Unfortunately, I don't have the information off the top of my head, but it's on our website, queersagainstapartheid.org, and the Trans March tonight at 7 p.m. So those are the three most immediate ways, and also donations are always welcome, which you can make at our website. But I think the first thing is for people to educate themselves. We have a lot of material on our website. Get familiar with the issues, feel comfortable talking about them, understand why it's important that queers as queers talk about Israeli apartheid. And you know, if you're not in Toronto, you know, start up your own group in wherever you are, or come join Kwaya. I think those are the sort of the first things I'd say.
So, Corbin, one more question. I'm wondering, you know, there's been discussion and at least a push from a lot of the Zionist organizations and lobbies talking about, well, why would you stand up for Palestinian liberation when, quote-unquote, Palestine is not a queer-friendly place, right? And they highlighted, of course, as you said earlier, Israel as being this democratic, liberal democratic oasis where gay rights are fostered. And I'm wondering what the response is from Quia around that claim.
Well, one thing is that, you know, homophobia is everywhere. It's in Canada, it's in Israel, it's all over the world, and we never have shied about talking about that. And so, yes, there is homophobia in Palestine. But, you know, the single biggest obstacle to organizing for queer rights in Palestine is Israeli apartheid and the occupation. You can't organize under those conditions for queer rights when the basic conditions of your life are so difficult. Mm-hmm. So that's the first step. And, you know, as soon as the apartheid system is dismantled, which means respecting the three calls of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, namely right of return for all Palestinian refugees, dismantling the apartheid wall and ending the occupation, and full equality for Arab citizens of Israel. As soon as those conditions are there, then Palestinians, queer Palestinians, are going to be able to, you know, basically lead their own struggles, which they're already doing, but under very difficult circumstances. And the other problem with that is, you know, queer rights everywhere have been won as a result of struggle by queer people. It's not that, you know, any country is somehow inherently better because right now there are rights enshrined in the laws. You know, 20, 40 years ago, think about what the conditions were for LGBT people in Canada and what the struggles were, which involved a lot of criminalization, a lot of violence, for people to get from there to where we are now, which is not even to say that it's perfect. So the idea that there's this static thing about Palestine or Israel that somehow signifies one society or civilization is better than another is really quite, it's very ignorant of how change actually happens. And if people were interested in supporting queer Palestinians, they wouldn't be trying to use their experience of homophobia to essentially demonize a whole people or a whole nation.
Thanks so much, Corbin. This is great. You know, the Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, it's always so much fun to march with you folks. So we'll definitely be out there on Saturday, on Sunday, all together.